Welcome. This is the evening course on the Nibbana Sermons 1 to 11 by Bhikkhu Katakurunda Jnanananda, a course hosted by the Numata Center for Buddhist Studies at the University of Hamburg in collaboration with the Paris Center for Buddhist Studies in Massachusetts. And today we are going to take a look at sermon number 3. But before that, there were a few points left over from the discussion of related to the previous talk. One thing was a question to clarify my use of the distinction between prescriptive and descriptive. So I was intending these as main patterns, not thereby wanting to say that there cannot be descriptions at all in the suttas. And I would like to quote Hyo Cho, because I think he very nicely put it to the point. He says, about prescriptive versus descriptive, I find this distinction quite helpful in the sense that the early discourses aim to give a general guideline or prescription on practice, rather than analyze a complete description of phenomena as later commentaries. The key difference here is the purpose. When we prescribe, the purpose is at the forefront, but when we describe, we risk being flushed and carried away by our own weakness for conceptual proliferation. I thought that really nicely captures the distinction that I was intending to make. Then the imagery of the whirlpool really touched, I think, all of us. And particularly interesting, I found that Katrina, she shared her personal experience of actually being caught up in a whirlpool that made it very palatable. I found similar to regard to the first sermon, the descriptions of those who had experience of wildfire. These personal experiences make it help all of us to relate to this type of imagery. And then there was a comment by Robert. He says, in fact, when Vijnanananda was absolutely on the spot, that a whirlpool is usually formed by two opposing influences. For example, a specific kind of whirlpool forms behind stills of bridges. There the whirlpools are formed by an interplay of the fluid's momentum and static pressure in the fluid behind the still. Due to friction, the fluid is slowed down. If it is too slow, the static pressure of the main flow behind the still just pushes it back upstream. Interestingly, such whirlpools or eddies usually disconnect from their place of formation, are then carried along with the main flow. The rotating body of fluid has stored kinetic energy, hence the whirling continues until all kinetic energy has been dissipated. I find it very helpful to have this physical perspective also on the formation of a whirlpool to make better sense of this imagery. Then I like to quote Margaret Romang on the point that all the teachings point to Nibbana, and she says that it's like clearing the fog when one gets lost in it. I speak for myself here. And she also speaks for myself, I think. And Anne Dillon made the comment that as Vijnanananda lays out a map of Nibbana, he's at the same time revealing what has been accomplished by noble ones, which serves to point back to what still needs to be done. Then the core teachings of the Buddha provide the how to do. Hedwig commented that she always felt it necessary to understand the entire Paticca-samuppada series, and now it seems more open for investigation. And I think this very well captures what I understand the Vijnanananda is trying to do in the last and also in the present sermon. And I would relate it again to the insight knowledges. The second one, the Paccaya Parigraha, which builds on Nama-rupa Paricheda Jnana, and concerns the clear understanding of conditionality. And I understand that, my understanding is that the Vijnanananda is trying to help us to see the moon instead of looking at the finger, to use this simile. And first, by showing that, and this was the chief topic of the second sermon, that the 12 links is not the essence of Paticca-samuppada, but the exemplification of it. And in the present sermon number 3, pointing out that the three life interpretation is not the only mode of understanding the 12 links, and that in particular, the entire series of 12 links can be experienced here and now, and one does not need to have past life recollections in order to access the first two links, which is the topic we will come to during the sermon. So that much for what the very rich discussion on the forum brought up in relation to sermon number 2. And now we are ready for sermon number 3. Etang santang, etang panitang, yaridang sabba sankara samatho, sab upari patinisango, tanhankayo virago nirodho nippanam. This is peaceful, this is excellent, namely the stilling of all preparations, the relinquishment of all assets, the destruction of craving, detachment, cessation, extinction. With the permission of the Most Venerable Great Preceptor and the Assembly of the Venerable Meditative Monks, today we have before us the third sermon on Nibbana. The other day, with the help of the simile of a whirlpool, we attempted an explanation of the terms samsara on the one hand and Nibbana on the other, that is to say, going round, or samsarana, and going out, or nissarana. Comment, I think he is also a little bit playing here on the name of the monastery in which they were all staying at the time these sermons were given, which is Nissaranavanaya. End of comment. We also cited suttas to illustrate both the arising samudaya and cessation nirodha aspects of the law of dependent arising. As regards this whirlpool, to show a parallel development with the links of the law of dependent arising, by way of a sustained simile, we may say that the ignorance in presuming that it is possible to go against the mainstream of the three signata, impermanence, suffering, and not-self, is the place of its origin. That heap of preparations impaired by ignorance, which takes the current forward, may be regarded as sankharas, and where the current in its progress clashes with the mainstream to become a whirlpool, that pushing forward against the mainstream is vijnana, or consciousness. The outcome of the clash is nama-rupa, or name and form, with its formal name and nominal form. That link in the formula of dependent arising called salayatana, or six sense bases, could be regarded as the outgrowth of this name and form. We can understand that link, too, in relation to the simile of the whirlpool. As the whirlpool goes on for a long time, an abyss is formed, the functioning of which could be compared to the six sense bases. As a matter of fact, bodily pains are comparable to an abyss. In a certain sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya, the Buddha says, Sariri kānaṁ ko etaṁ bhikkhave dukkhānaṁ vidanānaṁ adivacanaṁ yadidaṁ pātāloti. Monks, abyss is a synonym for painful bodily feelings. Comment. Here is the translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi, and I am going also a little bit further to give more background to the quote given by Venerable Jñānānanda. This, because, is rather a designation for painful bodily feelings, that is, a bottomless abyss. When the uninstructed worldling is contacted by a painful bodily feeling, he sorrows, grieves, and laments. He weeps and beats his breast and becomes distraught. This is called an uninstructed worldling who has not risen up in the bottomless abyss, one who has not gained a foothold. But because when the instructed noble disciple is contacted by a painful bodily feeling, he does not sorrow, grieve, or lament. He does not weep and beat his breast and become distraught. This is called an instructed noble disciple who has risen up in the bottomless abyss, one who has gained a foothold. And below I'm also giving the Chinese parallel, which makes basically the same point. And I think this highlight on painful bodily feelings as the abyss is very significant. It shows an important dimension of the early Buddhist meditative attitude of dealing with disease and pain. And the same also comes to the forefront in the Salla Sutta, which the Venerable Nyananana in fact will mention soon, where we have this simile of two darts or two arrows. One of these is bodily pain, but the second one is the mental reaction. And so there, being hit or struck by one arrow or dart, there is no need to get into getting hit or struck by the second one, the mental reactions. And I personally found this very interesting. In a few years ago, I was invited to give research and talk on the topic of healing in early Buddhism at a conference in the UK. And when I started to research, I found that all the majority of the publications that I was could find on this topic had all been focusing on mainly on Vinaya passages, where we have the Jivaka, the famous doctor, and his various cures. And now Jivaka was, of course, himself a Buddhist, and he also looked after the Buddha and his monks. But his cures, he learned them when he was living at his study period in Takasila. So his actual cures are not specifically Buddhist in a sense. They were just ancient Indian Ayurvedic knowledge. And so I came out with the finding that actually what this discourse here describes, the ability of the instructed noble disciple to handle bodily feeling without sorrowing, grieving, or lamenting, is a major aspect of the early Buddhist attitude towards healing. And that a particularly important tool here is mindfulness, the ability to bear pain with mindfulness, which makes a world of difference in the actual experience of pain and also the subsequent healing. And so, in a way, we could say that there is a very clear precedence in early Buddhist thought for the modern-day clinical usage of mindfulness by a practice such as mindfulness-based stress reduction. End of comment. When one comes to think about that statement, it would appear that the thirst of craving arises in beings in various forms of existence because of painful feeling. The Sallatthena Sutta adds to this by stating that the uninstructed worldling, on being touched by painful feeling, delights in sense pleasures, because he knows no way out of painful feeling other than the sense pleasures. In the light of that statement, it seems that the abyss is the endless barrage of painful feelings. The force of attraction that arises from the abyss is like the thirst to quell those painful feelings. The grasping that follows is the functioning of the same force of attraction. It attracts all the flotsam and jetsam around it, as things organically appropriated, upadinna, to put up a show of existence or bhava. That is, a spot that can be pointed out with the help of things, thus grasped by the whirlpool. So this whirlpool or vortex simile gives us some idea of the law of dependent arising. Comment. Yeah, I just want to stress again the powerful aspect of relating this simile of the whirlpool to the abyss of painful feelings and to the degree to which much of our activities are actually motivated by avoiding painful feelings. Think of eating and drinking to avoid the pain of hunger and thirst. Think of clothing, eating, building houses to avoid the pain of the body being at the mercy of outside temperature, etc., etc., etc. End of comment. The insight into the basic principle of dependent arising is in fact regarded as the arising of the eye of Dhamma. About the stream winner, it is said that the dustless, stainless eye of Dhamma has arisen in him. The following phrase, which sums up the significance of that Dhamma eye, comes up quite often in the discourses. Yang kinchi samudaya dhammang sabbang tang nirodha dhammang. whatever is of a nature to arise, all that is of a nature to cease. Sometimes it is briefly alluded to with a couple of terms samudaya and nirodha, as samudayo, samudayo, and nirodho, nirodho. It is as if the experience of that insight has found expression as an exclamation, arising, arising, ceasing, ceasing. The above phrase only connects up the two aspects of that experience. It seems then that what is called the Dhamma eye is the ability to see the nibbanic solution in the very vortex of the samsaric problem. That way of analysis, which puts samsara and nibbana far apart, into two watertight compartments, as it were, gives rise to interminable problems. But here we see that just as much as one could realize nibbana by discovering the cause of suffering and following the path to its cessation, which in effect is the understanding of the Four Noble Truths, one could also put an end to this vortex by understanding its cause and applying the correct means for its cessation. In the previous sermon, we happened to quote some canonical verses, which declare that the vortex does not exist for an arahant. Now, as regards the condition after the cessation of the vortex, if someone asks where the vortex or the whirlpool has gone, what sort of answer can we give? It is the same difficulty that comes up in answering the question, where has the fire gone after it has gone out? Because here, too, what we call the whirlpool is that current of water which went against the mainstream. It also consists of water, like the body of water outside it. So we cannot say that they united, nor can we say that it went and hid somewhere. Here we find ourselves in a queer situation. All we can say, in fairness to truth, is that there had been a certain form of activity, a certain state of unrest due to certain causes and conditions. Because of that activity that was going on there, it was possible to designate it, to give it a name. By worldly convention, one could refer to it as that place or this place. The entire field of activity was called a whirlpool by worldly convention. But now, the so-called whirlpool is no more. The worldly convention is no more applicable as in the case of an extinguished fire. The word fire was introduced, the concept of fire was created, to designate a certain state of affairs that arose due to causes and conditions due to graspings. So from this also, we can see that it is in concepts that ignorance finds a camouflage. Being unaware of it, the world goes on amassing concepts and even expects to see them in Nibbana. There are some who fondly hope to get a vision of their lists of concepts when they realize Nibbana. But that wisdom penetrates through even the concepts, and that is why it is called Udayatta Gamini Panya Arya Nibbedika, the Aryan penetrative wisdom that sees the rise and fall. The idea of penetration is already implicit in the phrase Yam Kinchi Samudaya Dhammam Sabbang Tang Nirodha Dhammam. Whatever is of a nature to arise, all that is of a nature to cease. If anything has the nature to arise, by that very nature it is bound to come to its end. And that is why the wandering ascetic Upatissa, who was to become Venerable Sariputta later, attained the fruit of a stream winner, even on hearing the first two lines of the verse uttered by the Venerable Asati, Ye dhamma hetu pabhava tesam hetum tathagato aha. Of things that arise from a cause, their cause the Tathagata has told. When a wise man hears that something has arisen due to causes and conditions, he immediately understands that it could be made to cease by the removal of those conditions, even without further explanation. It is the dustless, stainless Dhamma eye that enables one to see the Nibbanic solution in the very structure of the samsaric problem. In our quotation from the Mahanidana Sutta, it was said that all pathways for verbal expression, terminology and designation exist so long as the vortex of samsara is kept going. The implication, therefore, is that they have no existence beyond it. This is the significance of the word ettavata insofar only. Ettavata jayatava, jiyatava, miyatava, chavetava, upapanjatava. Insofar only can one be born, or grow old, or die, or pass away, or reappear. So the concepts of birth, decay and death, passing away and reappearing, are meaningful only in the context of the samsaric vortex between consciousness and name and form. If somehow or other this interrelation could be broken, this samsaric vortex, the whirlpool, could be stopped, then, after that, nothing remains to be said, nothing remains to be predicated. And as it is said in the Upasiva Sutta of the Sutta Nipata, yena nam vajju tam tassa nati, that by which they would speak of him, that for him exists not. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi, there is no means by which they might speak of him. End of comment. There are a number of canonical passages that show us the relevance of this vortex simile to the understanding of the doctrine of Paticca-samuppada. In the Mahapadana Sutta of the Digha Nikaya, we find a lengthy description of the manner in which the Bodhisattva Vipassi got an insight into Paticca-samuppada. We are told that his mode of approach was one of radical reflection, or yoniso manasikara, literally attention by way of the matrix. One might as well say that it is an attention by way of the vortex. It is as if a man with keen vision, sitting under a tree by a river, were to watch how a fallen leaf gets carried away by the water current, only to get whirled up and disappear in a vortex. It is clearly stated that in the case of Vipassi Bodhisattva, that his understanding through wisdom came as a result of radical reflection. Yoniso manasikara aho panyai abhisamayo. So his insight into Paticca-samuppada was definitely not due to recollection of past lives. Yoni means the matrix, or the place of origin. So in yoniso manasikara, always the attention has to turn towards the place of origin. So, true to this method, we find the Bodhisattva Vipassi starting his reasoning from the very end of the Paticca-samuppada formula. King hi noko sati jaramaranam hoti, king paccaya jaramaranam. Given what does decay and death come to be? From which condition comes decay and death? And to this question, the following answer occurred to him. Jatiya ko sati jaramaranam hoti, jati paccaya jaramaranam. Given birth, does decay and death come to be? From birth as condition comes decay and death. In the same manner, taking pair by pair, he went on reasoning progressively. For instance, his next question was, Kingi no kosati jati hoti, king paccaya jati. Given what, does birth come to be? From which condition comes birth? And the answer to it was, Bhave kosati jati hoti, bhava paccaya jati. Given becoming, birth comes to be. From becoming as condition comes birth. He went on reasoning like this up to and including name and form. But when he came to consciousness, he had to turn back. When he searched for the condition of consciousness, he found that name and form itself is the condition, whereby he understood their interdependence. And then he gave expression to the significance of his discovery in the following words. Pachudavantati ko idam vinyanam nama rupam ha na parangacchati. Etntavata jayatava, jiyatava, miyatava, chavetava, upapanjatava. Yadidam nama rupa pachaya vinyanam. Vinyana pachaya nama rupam. Nama rupa pachaya salayatanam. Salayatana pachaya phaso. Hassa pachaya vedana, vedana pachaya tanha, tanha pachaya upadanam, upadana pachaya bhavo, bhava pachaya jati, jati pachaya jaramarnam, soka parideva dukkha dumana supayasa sambhavanti. Eva metas kevalas dukkha khandas samudayo hoti. By means of radical reflection, the Bodhisattva Vipassi understood that all concepts of birth, decay and death converge on the relationship between consciousness and name and form. This consciousness turns back from name and form. It does not go beyond. In so far can one be born or grow old or die or pass away or reappear. In so far as this is, namely, consciousness is dependent on name and form and name and form on consciousness. Dependent on name and form, the six sense bases. Dependent on the six sense bases, contact. Dependent on contact, feeling. Dependent on feeling, craving. Dependent on craving, grasping. Dependent on grasping, becoming. Dependent on becoming, birth. And dependent on birth, decay and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair come to be. Thus is the arising of this entire mass of suffering. Comment. The Chinese parallel in the Dirga Agama, also reporting on the awakening of the former Buddha Vipassi, only presents his tracing the links in rising and cessation mode, and then immediately turns to his awakening. So it does not explicitly mention the reciprocal conditioning between name and form. It also does not refer to Vipassi's contemplation of the five aggregates after having investigated Paticchasamuppada. However, we have a parallel in Sanskrit fragments, and this does have the reciprocal conditioning of consciousness and name and form. And it also mentions that he contemplated the impermanent nature of the five aggregates. In addition, the Sanskrit version also mentions that he cultivated the set of mental qualities conducive to awakening. Asya darshanam chotpannam sambodha pakshikeshu dharmeshu kshiname jatirushitam brahmacharyam kritam karaniyam napanangasmat bhavan prajanami. So alongside some variations, all versions agree that the Buddha Vipassi reached awakening, discovered all of the 12 links of dependent arising without having cultivated recollection of past lives. And so this underscores the point made by the Venerable Nyanananda that even the one who discovered the 12-link formulation of dependent arising, leave alone those who want to follow that discovery, did not have to rely on going back into a past life in order to see the first two links of ignorance and formations. End of comment. The fact that this understanding of Paticchasamuppada signified the rising of the Dhamma eye in Vipassi Bodhisattva is stated in the following words. Samudayo samudayo tiko bhikkave vipassissa bodhisattasya pumbe an anusutesu dhammesu chakkum udapadi jnanam udapadi panya udapadi vijja udapadi aloko udapadi. Arising, arising, thus, O monks, in regard to things unheard of before, there arose in the Bodhisattva Vipassi the eye, the knowledge, the wisdom, the science and the light. Comment. Yeah, I just like to briefly mention personal translation preferences in the context like the above. I would personally prefer to translate aloka as clarity, which is also, in my understanding, the implication the term carries as an antidote to the hindrance of sloth and torpor, where aloka sanya, I don't think, could be meant perception of light, but much more clarity of perception. And along the same line of light-related terminology, I also find it preferable to translate bodhi as awakening rather than as enlightenment. And for anybody interested in other scholars who share also this preference and several arguments, I've given here the reference in my comparative study of the Majjhima Nikaya. End of comment. In the same way, it is said that the Bodhisattva clarified for himself the cessation aspect through radical reflection. Kimi nuko asati jara maranam nahoti, kissa niruddha jara maranam niruddho. In the absence of what will decay and death not be? With the cessation of what is the cessation of decay and death? And as the answer to it, the following thought occurred to him. jatiya ko asati jara maranam na hoti, jati niruddha jara maranam nirodho. In the absence of birth, there is no decay and death. With the cessation of birth is the cessation of decay and death. Likewise, he went on reflecting progressively until he reached the link between name and form and consciousness, and then it occurred to him, nama rupa niruddha vijnana niruddho, vijnana niruddha nama rupa niruddho. From the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of consciousness. From the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of name and form. Once this vital link is broken, that is, when consciousness ceases with the cessation of name and form, and name and form ceases with the cessation of consciousness, then all the other links following name and form, such as the six sense bases, contact and feeling, come to cease immediately. The Mahapadana Sutta goes on to say that the Bodhisattva Vipassi continue to dwell seeing the rising and passing away of the five grasping groups, and that before long his mind was fully emancipated from the influxes, and that he attained to full enlightenment. It is also said in the sutta in this connection that the Bodhisattva followed this mode of reflection because he understood that it is the way of insight leading to awakening. Adhikatukam nyayam vipassana mango buddhaya. I have found this path of insight to awakening, to enlightenment. And as we saw above, the most important point, the pivotal point in this path of insight is the relationship between name and form and consciousness. The commentary raises the question why the Bodhisattva Vipassi makes no mention of the first two links, avidya and sankhara, and gives the explanation that he could not see them as they belong to the past. But this is not the reason. The very ignorance regarding the relationship between name and form and consciousness is avidya, or ignorance. And what accounts for the continuity of this relationship is sankhara, comment, formations, end of comment. It is because of these preparations that the vortical interplay between consciousness and name and form is kept going. Simply because the first two links are not mentioned in the sutta, the commentators give the explanation that they belong to the past. But it should be clear that the Bodhisattva Vipassi could not have aroused the Dhamma eye without those two links. Why they are not specially mentioned here is because they are in the background. It is true that there is a mode of exposition in which avidya or ignorance takes precedence. But what we have here is a different mode of exposition, according to which one has to stop short at the interrelation between consciousness and name and form. As to the cause of this mutual relationship, we have to go back to the vortex simile. Usually, the progress of a current of water is visible at some distance away from the vortex. In this case, the current of water forgets its own impermanent suffering and not-self nature, and goes ahead in search of a permanent, pleasurable and self nature, and this itself is avidya or ignorance. This very tendency of the narrow water current to push on against the main body of water is itself what is called consciousness. Similarly, in the context of the samsaric individual, what forms the background for the interplay between consciousness and name and form is the non-understanding that the net result of the interplay is suffering, that it only leads to suffering. In other words, it is the tendency to go ahead in search of a state of permanence, pleasure and self, ignoring the three characteristics of impermanence, suffering and not-self. The heap of preparations or efforts arising out of that tendency are the sankharas. It is on these very preparations or efforts that consciousness depends, and then we have name and form existing in relation to it. On the side of name and form, or beyond it, we have all the other links of the paticca-samuppada. So in this way we can form a mental picture of the formula of paticca-samuppada by some sort of a pictorial explanation. It seems then that this discourse is further proof of the statements found in the Mahanindana Sutta. There is yet another discourse, one preached by Venerable Sariputta, which supports our conclusions. It is found in the Nidana Samyutta of the Samyutta Nikaya. There Venerable Sariputta brings out a simile that is even simpler than the vortex simile. he compares consciousness and name and form to two bundles of weeds. When two bundles of weeds stand, one supporting the other, if one of those is drawn out, the other would fall down. And if the latter is drawn out, the former will fall down. Ekam akadheya eka papateya. Aparanche akadheya apara papateya. The mutual interrelation between consciousness and name and form is like that of two bundles of weeds, mutually supporting each other. Having given this simile, Venerable Sariputta goes on to mention the other links of the Paticca-samuppada formula, as in the case of the Bodhisattva Vipassi's insight. It runs, dependent on name and form, the six sense bases. Dependent on the six sense bases, contact. Dependent on contact, feelings. And so on. And then the cessation aspect of these links is also given. By way of illustration, let us suppose that the consciousness bundle of reeds is standing on the left side, and the name and form bundle is on the right. Then we have a number of other bundles, such as the six sense bases, contact and feeling, all leaning on to the name and form bundle of reeds. These are all dependent on the name and form bundle. Now, as soon as the consciousness bundle is drawn out, all the others on the right side fall down immediately. There is no interval. True to the qualities of the Dhamma summed up in the terms Sandittika, Akalika, and Eipassika, that is, to be seen here and now, not involving time and inviting one to come and see, the entire mass of samsaric suffering ceases immediately. So this discourse is further proof of the fact that we have here quite a different state of affairs than what is commonly believed to be the significance of the Paticca-samuppada formula. That is why we have pointed out that the concepts of birth, decay and death are of the nature of fading away. That is also why decay and death have been described as impermanent, made up, independently arisen, of a nature to wither away, pass away, fade away and cease. Anicchaṁ, saṅkhataṁ, paticca-samuppannaṁ, kāya-dhammaṁ, vāya-dhammaṁ, virāga-dhammaṁ, nirodha-dhammaṁ. When one comes to think of it, one may find it difficult to understand why decay and death are called impermanent and withering or decaying. But the reason is that all concepts, insofar as they are leaning on to the name and form bundle, have to fall down when the opposite bundle of reeds is drawn out. That is to say, that the entire mass of samsaric suffering ceases immediately and the whirlpool of samsara comes to an end. This then seems to be the most plausible conclusion. According to the interpretation we have adopted in the Mahahattipadopama Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, Venerable Sariputta brings out as a quotation a certain statement of the Buddha on Paticca-samuppada. It runs, Yo Paticca-samuppadaṃ passati, so Dhammaṃ passati. Yo Dhammaṃ passati, so Paticca-samuppadaṃ passati. He who sees the law of dependent arising sees the Dhamma. He who sees the Dhamma sees the law of dependent arising. Comment. I have just added the Chinese parallel which makes the same statement. End of comment. This shows that the quintessence of the Dhamma is in fact the law of dependent arising itself. Now, there are these six qualities of the Dhamma summed up in the well-known formula which every Buddhist believes in. This Dhamma is well preached, svakkhato. It can be seen here and now, sandittiko. That is, one can see it by oneself here in this very world. It is timeless, akkaliko. It invites one to come and see, ehipassiko. It leads one on, opanayiko. It can be realized by the wise, each one by himself, pacchattang viditabbo vinyuhi. Though we all have faith in these qualities of the Dhamma, let us see whether the traditionally accepted interpretation of Paticca-samuppada is faithful to these qualities, particularly to the two qualities sandittiko and akkaliko. According to that accepted interpretation presented by the venerable author of the Visuddhimagga, the first two links of the formula belong to the past, and the last two links belong to the future. The remaining eight links in the middle are taken to represent the present. That means we have here the three periods of time. So it is not timeless. And that is why they explain that the Bodhisattva Vipassi did not see the first two links. Perhaps the presumption is that since these two links belong to the past, they can be seen only by the knowledge of the recollection of past lives. But on the other hand, the suttas tell us that even the stream winner has a clear understanding of Paticchasamuppada. Ariyo chasa nyaya panyaya sudikto hoti supatividdho. By him the noble known is well seen and well penetrated through with wisdom. The noble known is none other than the law of dependent arising, and the stream winner has seen it well, penetrated into it well with wisdom. The prefix su implies the clarity of that vision. The question then is how a stream winner, who has no knowledge of the recollection of past lives, can get this insight. Whatever it may be, the accepted interpretation, as already mentioned, puts the first two links into the past. That is to say, ignorance and preparations are referred to the past. Birth, decay and death are referred to the future. The eight links in between are explained with reference to the present. Thus the formula is divided into three periods. Not only that, in the attempt to interpret the formula as referring to three stages in the samsaric journal of an individual, additional links had to be interposed to prop up the interpretation. Ignorance, preparations, craving, grasping and becoming are regarded as the past causes. Depending on these past causes, consciousness, name and form, six sense bases, contact and feeling are said to rise as results in the present. And again, with ignorance, preparations, craving, grasping and becoming as present causes, consciousness, name and form, six sense bases, contact and feeling arise as results in the future. This kind of interpretation is also advanced. But this interpretation in terms of pentas violates the interrelatedness between the 12 links in the formula. We have already drawn attention to the fact of interrelation between the two links in each pair. In fact, that itself has to be taken as the law of dependent arising. That is, the basic principle itself. Because of one, the other arises. With its cessation, the other ceases. There is this mode of analysis, but then it is disrupted by the attempt to smuggle in additional links into the formula. Furthermore, according to this accepted commentary exegesis, even the term bhava, or becoming, is given a twofold interpretation: as karma process becoming and rebirth process becoming. In the context upadana panchaya bhavo, dependent on grasping is becoming, it is explained as rebirth process becoming. While in the context case of the other context, bhava panchaya jati, dependent on becoming is birth, it is taken to mean karma process becoming. So the same term is explained in two ways. Similarly, the term jati, which generally means birth, is said to imply rebirth in the context of the formula of dependent arising. There are many such weak points in the accepted interpretation. Quite a number of authoritative modern scholars have pointed this out. Now, all these shortcomings could be sidetracked if we grant the fact, as already mentioned, that the secret of the entire samsaric vortex is traceable to the two links, consciousness and name and form. As a matter of fact, the purpose of the formula of dependent arising is to show the way of rising and cessation of the entire mass of suffering, and not to illustrate three stages in the samsaric journey of an individual. The distinctive feature of this law of dependent arising is its demonstrability in the present, as suggested by the terms to be seen here and now and timeless, even as the Bodhisattva Vipassi discovered it through radical reflection itself. The salient characteristic of the teaching of the Buddha is its visibility here and now and timelessness. This fact is well revealed by the Himaka Sutta of the Sutta Nipata. The Brahmin youth Himaka sings praise of the Buddha in the following verses: Yeme pubme miyakangsu hurang gotama sasana icchasi iti bhavissati sabbang tam iti hitiham. Sappang tang takkavadhanam nahang tatta abhiramin. Tvanchami dhammang akkahi tanhani ghatanang muni. Yang viditva satocharam tare loke visattikam. Those who explained to me before, outside the dispensation of Gautama, all of them said, so it was, and so it will be. But all this is that is so-and-so talk, all that is productive of logic, I did not delight therein. But now to me, O sage, proclaim your Dhamma, that is destructive of craving, by knowing which, and mindfully faring along, one might get beyond the world's viscosity. Comment, here's the translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Those who in the past explained things to me, said the Venerable Hemaka, prior to meeting Gautama's teaching, saying such it was, such it will be, all that was hearsay, all that was an increase of thought, I did not delight therein. Declare to me the Dhamma, O Muni, the destruction of craving, having understood which, living mindfully, one can cross attachment to the world. End of comment. Now to paraphrase, whatever teachers explain to me their teachings outside your dispensations, used to bring in the past and the future in the explanations, saying, so it was, and so it will be. That is, they were always referring to a past and a future. But all that can be summed up as so-and-so talk. By the way, the term iti itya had already become a technical term for hearsay among the ascetics. Such teachings based on hearsay were productive of logic, as for instance testified by the Sabbasava Sutra of the Majjhima Nikaya. Was I in the past? Was I not in the past? What was I in the past? How was I in the past? Having been what? What did I become in the past? Shall I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? Having been what? What shall I become in the future? And so on. Comment. I just like to point out that this passage is sometimes being seen as a refutation of the idea of rebirth or concern with past lives and future lives, and this is not correct. In fact, as Venerable Nyanananda clearly pointed out, it's on the same line of logic or speculation or even conceiving that is being questioned here, and the present passage from the Sabbasava Sutta needs to be read in conjunction with the recurrent reference to recollection of past lives as an actual experience, which in fact is one of the knowledges and insights the Buddha is on record for having cultivated in the night of his awakening. So the point is only that what is discouraged in the Sabbasava Sutta is endless speculation and conceiving rather than having direct experience. End of comment. But I was not pleased with such teachings, says Hemaka. It is only you, O sage, who teaches the Dhamma that destroys the craving in the present, understanding which and mindfully following it accordingly, one could go beyond the sticky craving in the world. Hemaka's praise of the Buddha was inspired by this most distinctive feature in the Dhamma. We have already stated that by Dhamma is meant the law of dependent arising. This is further proof that the basic principle underlying the formula of dependent arising could be traced to the constant relationship between consciousness and name and form, already present in one's mental continuum, without running into the past or leaping towards the future. We know that, in order to ascertain whether a banana trunk is pithless, it is not necessary to go on removing its bark layer after layer from top to bottom. We only have to take a sharp sword and cut the trunk in the middle, so that the cross-section will reveal to us its pithless nature. Similarly, if we cut in the middle the banana trunk of preparations with a sharp sword of wisdom, panyamayam tikkinasmasming gahitva, its internal structure, as revealed by the cross-section, will convince us of the essenceless nature of the group of preparations. Whatever existence there was in the past, that too had the same essenceless nature. And whatever existence there will be in the future, that will have the same essenceless. And I see it now, in my own mental continuum, as something visible here and now, not involving time. It is with such a conviction that the noble disciple utters the words, arising, arising, cessation, cessation. That is how he arrives at the realization summed up in the phrase, yam kinchi samudaya dhammam sabbam tang nirodha dhammam. Whatever is of the nature to arise, all that is of the nature to cease. All this goes to show that the accepted interpretation has certain shortcomings. To take up another simile, we have already alluded to the fact that the Buddha has been compared to a physician. Though this might well sound a modernism, we may say that the specialist doctor today needs only a drop of blood or blood tissue for a full diagnosis of a patient's disease. When seen under the microscope, that blood tissue reveals the pathological condition of the patient. Even the patient himself could be invited to see for himself the result of the blood test. Once the disease has been cured, the doctor could invite the patient again to undergo a blood test if he likes to assure himself of the fact that that disease has been effectively treated. The Buddha's teaching has a similar here, now, and timeless quality. What is noteworthy is that this quality is found in the law of dependent arising. Then there's another question that crops up out of this traditional interpretation of the formula of dependent arising. That is the reason why the two links, ignorance and preparations, are referred to the past. In some discourses, like the Mahanidana Sutta, there's a discussion about the descent of consciousness into a mother's womb. Simply because there is such a discussion, we might think that the law of dependent arising has reference to a period beyond one's conception in a mother's womb. But if we carefully examine the trend of this discussion and analyze its purpose, such a conclusion will appear to be groundless. The point which the Buddha was trying to drive home into Venerable Ananda by his catechism is that the constant interrelation that exists between consciousness and name and form is present even during one's life in the mother's womb. This catechism can be analyzed into four parts. The first question is, Vijnanam vahi ananda matu kutnchismin na opkamissata apinukho nama rupang matu kutnchismin sammuchissata. And Venerable Ananda's answer is, no hetam bhante. If Ananda, consciousness were not to descend into a mother's womb, would name and form remain there? It would not. Comment? Here's the translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. If consciousness were not to descend into the mother's womb, would name and form take shape in the womb? End of comment. The Buddha is asking whether name and form can persist in remaining inside the mother's womb, if consciousness refuses to descend into it, so to say. The word samuchissata presents a difficulty as regards etymology, but it is quite likely that it has to do with the idea of remaining, as it has an affinity to the word uchitta, leftover, remnant. So the point raised here is that in the event of a non-descent of consciousness into the mother's womb, name and form will not be left remaining there. Name and form has to have the support of consciousness. However, in this interrelation, it is consciousness that decides the issue. If consciousness does not descend, name and form will not remain there. So even if at the moment of death one has a thought of some mother's womb, if consciousness does not descend in the proper manner, name and form cannot stay there. Name and form has always to be understood in relation to consciousness. It is not something that is to be found in trees and rocks. It always goes hand in hand with consciousness. So the upshot of the above discussion is that name and form will not remain there without the support of consciousness. Venerable Ananda's response to the first question then is, that indeed is not the case, O Lord. Then the Buddha asks, Vijnanam vahi ananda matu kutnchisming okam kamitva vokam kamissata. Apinuko nama rupang ittattai abhinibbattissata. If Ananda, consciousness having descended into the mother's womb, were to slip out of it, would name and form be born into this state of existence? Venerable Ananda's reply to it is again, that indeed is not the case, Lord. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. If, after descending into the womb, consciousness were to depart, would name and form be generated into this state of being? End of comment. Now the question is, Ananda, If for some reason or other, consciousness, having descended into the mother's womb, slips out of it, will name and form secure birth as a thisness or it-tattā? We have mentioned above that it-tattā is a term with some special significance. That is how a there becomes a here. When a person takes birth in a particular form of existence, in short, what it implies is that the person comes to be born. In other words, if consciousness, having descended into the mother's womb, slips out of it, that name and form will not mature into a thisness and be born into a thisness. There is no possibility of the thisness coming into being. For there to be a thisness, both consciousness and name and form must be there. We can understand then why Venerable Ananda replied in the negative. The next question the Buddha puts is this. Vijñānaṁ vahi ānanda dhārasa eva sato vacchijjissatā kumārakassava kumārikāyava apinukho nāmarūpaṁ buddhiṁ virūlhiṁ vipullaṁ appajjissatā. If Ananda, the consciousness of a boy or girl, were cut off, when he or she is still young, will name and form come to growth and maturity? To that question too, Venerable Ananda replies, that indeed is not the case, Lord. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. If the consciousness of a young boy or girl were to be cut off, would name and form grow up, develop, and reach maturity? End of comment. Now the preliminary questions have been correctly answered. The Buddha then comes out with the following conclusion, since the necessary premises are complete. Tasmātiha ānanda eseva hetu etam niddhānam esa samudayo esa pachayo nāma rūpasa yadirāṁ viññānam. Therefore, Ānanda, this itself is the cause. This is the reason, origin and condition for name and form, namely consciousness. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Therefore, Ānanda, this is the cause, source, origin and condition for name and form, namely consciousness. End of comment. What is emphasized here is the importance of consciousness. Out of the two, namely consciousness and name and form, what carries more weight with it is consciousness, even if there be a trace of name and form. What the above questionnaire makes clear is that name and form arises in a mother's womb because of consciousness. But that name and form will not remain there if consciousness does not properly descend into the womb. Also, if consciousness, after its descent, were to slip out, name and form will not reach the state of a thisness. So much so that, even after one's birth as a boy or girl, if consciousness gets cut off in some way or other, name and form will not reach growth and maturity. So from all this, it is clear that consciousness is an essential condition for there to be name and form. Then the Buddha introduces the fourth step. Vijñānaṁ vahi ānanda nāma rūpe patittaṁ na labhissatā apinukho āyatin jāti jarā maraṇaṁ dukkha samudaya sambhavo paññāyathā. If ānanda, consciousness were not to find footing or get established in name and form, would there be an arising or origin of birth, decay, death and suffering in the future? No indeed, Lord, says Venerable Ānanda. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. If consciousness were not to get a footing in name and form, would an origination of the mass of suffering, of future birth, aging and death, be discerned? End of comment. Now this fourth point is extremely important. What it implies is that though the aforesaid is the normal state of affairs in samsara, if for some reason or other consciousness does not get established on name and form, if at all such a contrivance were possible, there will not be any samsaric suffering again. And this position too, Venerable Ananda grants. So from this discussion too, it is obvious that simply because there is a reference to a mother's womb in it, we cannot conclude that ignorance and preparations are past causes. It only highlights the mutual relationship between consciousness and name and form. Now, the question that comes up next is, how does consciousness not get established on name and form? In what respects does it not get established and how? the consciousness of a samsaric individual is always an established consciousness. It is in the nature of this consciousness to find a footing on name and form. These two go together. That is why in the Sampasada Niya Sutta of the Digha Nikaya it is mentioned in the discussion on the attainments to vision, Dasana Samapatti, that the person with such an attainment sees a man's stream of consciousness that is not cut off on either side, established in this world and in the next. Purisasya ca vijnana sotam pajanati ubhayato abhocchinna idhaloke patittitansya paraloke patittitansya. What is implied here is the established nature of consciousness. The consciousness of the samsaric individual is established both in this world and in the next. Another attainment of vision mentioned in the sutta concerns the seeing of a man's stream of consciousness not cut off on either side and not established in this world or in the next. And that is a reference to the consciousness of an arahant. So an arahant's consciousness is an unestablished consciousness, whereas the consciousness of a samsaric individual is an established consciousness. That is precisely why in the Saggatakavagga of the Samyutta Nikaya and in the Sārattha Pakkāsini, where the episode of Venerable Gaudiya's suicide is mentioned, it is said that though he cut his own neck intending to commit suicide, he was able to attain parinibbāna as an arahant by radically attending to the deadly pain. But Mara took him to be an ordinary person and hovered around in search of his consciousness in vain. The Buddha, on the other hand, declared that Venerable Gaudiya passed away with an unestablished consciousness. Appatittitena ca bhikkave vijnanena godhiko kulaputto parinibbuto. Amongst their clansmen, Gaudiya passed away with an unestablished consciousness. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. However, because with consciousness unestablished, the clansman Gaudiya has attained final nibbana. End of comment. The consciousness of an ordinary samsaric individual is always established. The above mentioned relationship is always there. Because of this, we can say that there is always a knot in the consciousness of the samsaric individual. For him, this world and the next world are tied together in a knot. In this case, what is needed is only the untying of the knot. There is no need of a fresh tying up, as the knot is already there. But the term Patisandhi Vijnana, or rebirth linking consciousness, is now so widely used that we cannot help making use of it even in relating a Jataka story. The idea is that after the death consciousness, there occurs a rebirth linking consciousness. However, some scholars even raise the question why a term considered so important is not to be found in the discourses. On many an occasion, the Buddha speaks about the descent into a womb. But apart from using such terms as okkanti, descent, gabbhasa avakkanti, descent into a womb, and uppatti, arising, he does not seem to have used the term patisandhi. What is meant by this term patisandhi? It seems to imply a tying up of two existences. After death, there is a relinking. We have mentioned above in connection with the simile of the bundles of reeds that when the consciousness bundle of reeds is drawn, the name and form bundle of reeds falls. And when the name and form bundle of reeds is drawn, the consciousness bundle of reeds falls. And that there is a relationship of mutuality condition between them. The question then is, why a tying up is brought in? Why granting the relationship by mutuality condition? Because, going by the same simile, it would be tantamount to saying that rebirth linking consciousness straightens up when death consciousness falls. As if, when one bundle of reed is drawn, the other straightens up. This contradicts the nature of mutuality condition. There is no timelessness here. Therefore, patisandhi is a term that needs critical scrutiny. The mental continuum of a samsaric being is always knotted with a tangle within and a tangle without. And it is already implicit in the relationship between consciousness and name and form. What happens at the dying moment is usually posed as a deep problem. But if we carefully examine the situation in the light of canonical discourses, we could see here an illustration of the law of dependent arising itself. Now, as far as this established consciousness and the unestablished consciousness are concerned, we have already drawn attention to the relationship between a here and a there. We came across the term ittatta, otherwise called ittabhava. As a rendering for it, we have used the term thisness. And then we have already pointed out that this ittabhava, or thisness, goes hand in hand with anyatta bhava, or otherwiseness. That is to say, wherever a thisness arises, wherever a concept of a something arises, as a rule, that itself is the setting in of transformation or change. Thisness and otherwiseness are therefore to be found in a pairwise combination. Wherever there is a thisness, there itself is an otherwiseness. So in this way, because of the fact that due to this thisness itself, wherever thisness arises, otherwiseness arises, together with it, wherever there is a there is always a here. This then is how the consciousness of the samsaric being functions. As for one's own everyday life is concerned, what is called the conscious body is the body with consciousness. Generally, we regard this body as something really our own. Not only that, we can also objectify things outside us, beyond our range of vision, things that are objects of thought or are imagined. That is what is meant by the canonical phrase, Imasmin cha savijnana ke kaya bahiddha cha sabba nimittesu ahankara mamankara mananusayana honti. There are no latencies by conceit to conceit by way of I-making and my-making regarding this conscious body and or outside science. Here's an alternative translation by Yanamoli. In regard to this body with its consciousness and all external signs, there is no I-making, mind-making or underlying tendency to conceit. End of comment. What it implies is that one can have latencies to conceit by way of I-making and my-making regarding this conscious body as well as outside signs. Now, if we consider the deeper implications of this statement, we can get at some new perspective for understanding the nature of the relationship between consciousness and name and form. If someone deeply attached to a person who is not near him, but living somewhere far, far away, is heavily immersed in some deep thought, then even if there is some painful contact, such as the prick of a fly or the bite of a mosquito, or even if another comes and shakes him by the shoulder, he might not feel it, because he is so immersed in thought. Now, why is that? Normally, the rightful place for consciousness is this body. But what has happened now is that it has gone away temporarily and united with the name and form outside, with that object far away. But it can be awakened. This is the way the mind travels. It is due to a lack of clear understanding about the journey of the mind that the concept of a relinking consciousness was found to be necessary. The way the mind travels is quite different from the way the body travels. The journey of the body is a case of leaving one place to go to another, but the mind's journey is not like that. It is a sort of whirling or turning round, as in the case of a whirlpool or a vortex. That is to say, just as in the case of a rubber band, which could be stretched lengthwise or crosswise, there's a certain whirling round going on between consciousness and name and form. It is because of that whirling motion, which could either be circular or oval-shaped, that consciousness and name and form could either get drawn apart or drawn in, as they go round and round in a kind of vertical interplay. So in a situation like the one mentioned above, for that person, the distant has become near. At the start, when he fell to thinking, it was a there for him. Then it became a here. And the here became a there. This brings out, in a subtle way, the relevance of these concepts to the question of understanding such teachings as the law of dependent arising. Concepts of a here and a there are, in a way, relative. They presuppose each other, itta bhava, thisness, and anyatta bhava, otherwiseness, referred to above, mean the same thing. Itta bhava goes hand in hand with anyatta bhava. They are bound in a pairwise combination. When you're dragging one, the other follows of necessity. It is the same in the case of the relationship between birth on the one hand and decay and death on the other, as already mentioned. Also, consciousness and name and form always move in an orbit. It is not something like the journey of the body. Thought goes, but it rests on consciousness. It gravitates towards consciousness. It is because consciousness also has gone there that we say someone is immersed or engrossed in some thought. It is consciousness that carries more weight. This is sufficiently clear even from the Dhamma discussion of the Buddha quoted above. If consciousness does not descend into a mother's womb, name and form will not remain there. If consciousness does not join in to provide the opportunity, it will not grow. This is the nature of the relationship between them. Though not well authenticated, cases have been reported of persons on the verge of death, going through such unusual experiences as visualizing their own body from some outside standpoint. Taking into consideration the above-mentioned relationship, this is quite understandable. That external standpoint might not be a place which has the ability to sustain that consciousness, or which is capable of creating a new body out of the four primary elements. All the same, it temporarily escapes and goes there, and is now wavering to decide whether or not to come back to the body, as it were. It is on such occasions that one visualizes one's own body from outside. Comment. I'd just like to mention that since the time of Venerable Nyanananda originally giving this sermons until now, these cases have been much better authenticated. There is a whole society dedicated to this. It's IANS, International Association of Near-Death Studies. And they also publish a regular journal, the Journal of Near-Death Studies. And these out-of-body experiences, during near-death experience, are by now fairly well reported, and several also appear to involve veridical perceptions. A survey of research on near-death experience can be found in this book by Holden, 2009. And what I found particularly interesting is also another book by Ring and Cooper called Mindsight, Near-Death and Out-of-Body Experience in the Blind. They document cases of people who have been even congenitally blind, but during a near-death experience were actually able to see. And to put in something a little bit more related to Buddhist canonical descriptions, in a paper that I will make available on the forum entitled Levitation in Early Buddhism, I have argued that the same leaving of the mind of the body and then being able to experience with the mind-made body would also be at the origin of the idea of levitation. And I argue that the idea that levitation actually involves the physical body might be a later development based on this mental travel. But so much just for additional information and in the hope of not taking us too far away from the main topic of this sermon. End of comment. So here we have the norm of the mind's behavior. Seen this way, there is no need for a fresh tying up or relinking, because it is the same vortex that is going on all the time. In the context of this samsaric vortex, the there becomes a here, and the here becomes a there. The distant becomes a near, and a near becomes a distant. It is owing to this state of affairs that the consciousness of the samsaric individual is said to be always established. There is a certain twin character about it. Whenever consciousness leaves this body for good, it goes and rests on a name and form object which it had already taken up. In other words, this is why the Buddha did not find it necessary to coin a new term to express the idea of conception in some mother's womb. consciousness has as its object name and form. It is precisely because of consciousness that one can speak of it as a name and form. It is like the shadow that falls on consciousness. Name and form is like an image. Now, in taking a photograph, there is a similar turn of events. Even if one does not pose for the photograph with so much makeup, even if one turns one's back to the camera, at least the shade of his shape will be photographed as an image, if not his form. Similarly, in the case of the samsaric individual, even if he does not entertain an intention or thought construct, if he has at least the latency, anusaya, that is enough for him to be reborn in some form of existence or other. That is why the Buddha has preached such an important discourse as the Chittana Sutta of the Nidana Samyutta in the Samyutta Nikaya. It runs, Yancha bhikkave chiteti, yancha pakkappeti, yancha anusyati, arammanang etamodi vinyanasa tittiya. Aramane sati patikta vinyanasa hoti, tasmi patiktite vinyane virulhe namarupas avakkanti hoti. Namarupa panchaya salayatanam, salayatana panchaya bhassu, bhassa panchaya vedana, vedana panchaya tanha, tanha panchaya upadanam, upadana panchaya bhavo, bhava panchaya jati, jati panchaya jaramaranam, sukha parideva dukkha dumana supayasa sambhavanti. Evametasya kevalasya dukkha kandhasya samurayo hoti. Monks, whatever one intends, whatever one mentally constructs, whatever lies latent, that becomes an object for the stationing of consciousness. There being an object, there comes to be an establishment of consciousness. When that consciousness is established and grown, there is the descent of name and form. Dependent on name and form, the six sense spaces come to be. Dependent on the six sense spaces arises contact. Dependent on contact arises feeling. Dependent on feeling, craving. Dependent on craving, grasping. Dependent on grasping, becoming. Dependent on becoming, birth. Dependent on birth, decay and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair come to be. Such is the rising of this entire mass of suffering. Then comes the second instance. A comment just offered the alternative translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Because what one intends and what one plans and whatever one has a tendency towards, this becomes a basis for the maintenance of consciousness. When there's a basis, there's a support for the establishing of consciousness. When consciousness is established and has come to grow, there's a descent of name and form. With name and form as condition, the six sense basis come to be. With the six sense basis as condition, contact. With contact as condition, feeling, craving, clinging, existence, birth. With birth as a condition, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure and despair come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. End of comment. Noce bhikave cheteti, noce pakappeti, attacha anusiti. Arammanang etam hoti vinyanasa tittiya. Arammanasati patitta vinyanasa hoti. Tasmi patitte vinyane virule namarupasa avakkanti hoti. Nama rupa pachaya salayatanam, salayatana pachaya bhassu, bhassa pachaya vidana, vidana pachaya tanha, tanha pachaya upadanam, upadana pachaya bhavo, bhava pachaya jati, jati pachaya jaramaranam, soka parideva, dukkha dumanas upayasa sambhavanti. Eva vetasya kevalasya dukkha kandasya samudayo hoti. Monks, even if one does not intend or construct mentally but has a latency, that becomes an object for the stationing of consciousness. There being an object, there comes to be the establishment of consciousness. When that consciousness is established and grown, there is the descent of name and form. Dependent on name and form, the six sense spaces come to be. Dependent on the six sense spaces arises contact, and dependent on contact, feeling, dependent on feeling, craving, dependent on craving, grasping, dependent on grasping, becoming, dependent on becoming, birth, dependent on birth, decay and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair come to be. Such is the rising of this entire mass of suffering. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. If because one does not intend and one does not plan, but one still has a tendency towards something, this becomes a basis for the maintenance of consciousness. When there's a basis, there's a support for the establishing of consciousness. When consciousness is established and has come to grow, there's a descent of name and form. With name and form as condition, the six sense bases come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. End of comment. The significance of this second paragraph is that it speaks of a person who, at the time of death, has no intentions or thought constructs as such, but he has the latency. This itself is sufficient as an object for the stationing of consciousness. It is as if he has turned his back to the camera, but got photographed all the same, due to his very presence there. Now comes the third instance. Yato chako bhikkhave no cheva citteti no cha pakkappeti no cha anusseti arammanam etam na hoti vijnanasya tittiya arammane asati patittha vijnanasya na hoti tat apatittite vijnane avirule nama rupasya avakanti na hoti nama rupa nirodha salayatana nirodho salayatana nirodha bhasa nirodho bhasa nirodha vedana nirodho Vedana nirodha, tanha nirodho, tanha nirodha, upadhana nirodho, upadhana nirodha, bhava nirodho, bhava nirodha, jati nirodho, jati nirodha, jara maranam, sukha parideva dukkha dumanasupayasa nirudhyanti, evam metasya kevalasya dukkha khandasya nirodho hoti. But monks, when one neither intends nor constructs mentally, and has no latency either, then there is not that object for the stationing of consciousness. There being no object, there is no establishment of consciousness. When consciousness is not established and not grown up, there is no descent of name and form. And with the cessation of name and form, there comes to be the cessation of the six sense bases. With the cessation of the six sense bases, the cessation of contact. With the cessation of contact, the cessation of feeling. With the cessation of feeling, the cessation of craving. With the cessation of craving, the cessation of grasping. With the cessation of grasping, the cessation of becoming. With the cessation of becoming, the cessation of birth. With the cessation of birth, the cessation of decay and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair come to cease. This is the cessation of this entire mass of suffering. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. But because when one does not intend and one does not plan and one does not have a tendency towards anything, no basis exists for the maintenance of consciousness. When there is no basis, there is no support for the establishing of consciousness. When consciousness is unestablished and does not come to grow, there is no descent of name and form. With the cessation of name and form comes cessation of the six sense bases. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. This third instance is the most significant. In the first instance, there were the intentions, thought constructs, and latency. In the second instance, that person had no intentions or thought constructs, but only latency was there. In this third instance, there is neither an intention nor a thought construct, and not even a latency. It is then that there comes to be no object for the stationing of consciousness. There being no object, there is no establishment of consciousness. And when consciousness is unestablished and not grown, there is no descent of name and form. When there is no descent of name and form, there at last comes to be that cessation of name and form with which the six sense bases and all the rest of it, down to the entire mass of samsaric suffering, cease altogether then and there. Comment. Again, difficult to summarize this very rich presentation, but a point that strikes me in particular is the significance of rebirth in relation to dependent arising. And I understand the main point to be that the entire understanding of dependent arising does not rely on the ability of recollecting past lives. At the same time, this crucial passage from the Mahanidana Sutta illustrates how rebirth takes place as a way of showing the interrelationship of consciousness and name and form. And this at the same time implies that the early Buddhist doctrine of rebirth does not involve a simple mind-body duality. Thank you for your attention.